25 years offering all sizes and widths of Birkenstocks, from clogs and sandals to work, dress, and sport shoes. Birkenstock Concepts offers repair and modification services and a certified podorthist and orthotist on staff. Today's broadcast is made possible in part by Euromart International Food Store on Springfield and Locust in Champaign, offering 8,000 food items from Europe, South America, the Middle East, and the Orient. The Euromart hosts a cheese and olive tasting from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. on Thursday, Friday, and Saturday.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for joining me today. On the program today, we take a look at our energy future. Journalist Paul Roberts has investigated the economics and politics of oil, oil demand and supply, and the future of alternative sources of energy. He believes the terrain we're on is treacherous, but he believes disaster can be averted if we act consciously and responsibly to make the transition to a new energy system. In his words, the shape of the next energy is being decided right now with or without our input. Paul Roberts is the author of the book, The End of Oil, On the Edge of a Perilous New World. The book is published by Houghton Mifflin. Listeners, I invite you to join the discussion with your questions and comments. You can join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. If it would be a long-distance call for you, call toll-free 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Paul Roberts is a regular contributor to Harper's Magazine. He's written about the timber industry, the auto industry, and the destruction of the Florida Everglades for the magazine. He's also contributed articles to publications including the New York Times Magazine, the New Republic, Newsweek, and Rolling Stone. Again, the phone numbers 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Paul Roberts, thanks for joining us this afternoon.
Well, thanks for having me.
Sure. Recently, we've heard about China's growing demand for oil to fuel its growing economy, and you take note of that as well as the growing demand for oil in the U.S. and Europe. Maybe to begin here this afternoon, if you wouldn't mind outlining for us the current demand for oil and projections for growth in that demand near term.
Well, you know, the world's using about 80 million barrels of oil every day. And, about a century ago, we were about 500,000 barrels a day. And depending on how demand goes over the next 30 years, we could see that rise by about 60%. So not quite doubling, but substantially more oil being used in the next 20 to 30 years than today. And so the real question is, where is it all going to come from? That's certainly an issue that's on the minds of, you know, not just oil companies, but, you know, the leaders of countries like the U.S. and Europe and Japan, which depend heavily on oil. And now, as you mentioned, China. You know, China's economy is growing like gangbusters. And although there will be attempts to slow the rate of growth because it's just too hot, it's a runaway economy at this point, they're still going to have fast growth there. They need it. And you can't have growth without energy, and especially oil.
And also a concern, something you term energy poverty. You call this a new killer in developing nations, the root cause of lots of problems, and perhaps a big divide, the biggest divide between haves and have-nots. You want to expand on that?
Well, sure. About 1.5 to 2 billion people now have very limited or no access to fossil fuels, electricity. You know, they're heating and cooking and lighting almost entirely with wood and animal dung, crop waste, what we call biomass, and it's the most primitive way to produce energy. It has all sorts of negative health impacts. I mean, if you're cooking over a wood fire, things you're doing to your lungs, you know, if you're spending the day gathering fuel, you're not educating yourself, you're not working at a job, and it's a problem that's, you know, as a is born predominantly by women because they're the ones who are in charge of home fuel. And once you can bring something like kerosene, even something as simple as kerosene, lamp fuel, to a village, say in Africa or Asia, you can change their lives immeasurably. And so what we have is energy poverty. And energy isn't the sole cause of poverty in these nations, but it's inextricably bound up with other issues of poverty. You know, until you have lights for your classroom, your education is going to be delayed or prohibitive, which means that, you know, your kids aren't going to be able to handle, you know, jobs that are other than menial. Until you can light your hospitals, your health care suffers. Until you can provide power for the pump in the well, you may have polluted water, contaminated water, so you've got this huge health problem. All these issues, all these energy applications turn out to be obstacles to making progress. And it's becoming more and more recognized that one of the key ingredients for progress in these countries is adequate supplies of energy.
Yeah. And even in places where the energy is, like, say, Nigeria, with political instability, what it is there, and with poverty, it is very difficult for an oil company to get the oil out of a place like Nigeria.
Well, it's a problem both for oil companies because, again, as you point out, an unstable environment makes it very tough to produce oil reliably and steadily. At the same time, there's a huge cost to the country itself because instead of using the companies are there, the Western outside companies are there primarily to take the energy out and sell it to the market. It doesn't really help the country as a whole. The money goes to the owners of the wealth, which is usually the government, which in many cases is corrupt. And it doesn't get distributed to the rest of the population. So you have essentially a few elites becoming richer and most of the rest of the country watching it happen and being very angry about it. And this isn't just Africa. This happens everywhere, that oil is the primary industry.
Yeah. Well, there's a political corruption issue here as well. I know that the SEC is investigating Halliburton subsidiary for bribes being paid in terms of natural gas project, getting a natural gas project going in Nigeria.
Well, and this is a I can't speak to the Halliburton case, but I can say that kind of relationship between outside energy companies and the host governments of these oil producing or gas producing countries, that relationship has always been one of kind of backroom deals. Oil companies have come in, they found the people in power, they've given them, you know, not just upfront contracts, but a lot of bribes to sweeten the deal and to, you know, maintain exclusive access to the oil reserves. And they basically helped prop up some of the worst governments in the world, often with the support or at least the awareness of the U.S. and other big importing governments, because the U.S. and these other, you know, Japan and Europe, they needed that oil, and they're willing to look the other way as oil companies set up fairly crooked deals with the governments of these oil-producing nations.
Yeah. We often hear the words energy and security put together, and one of the things you write about is oil and how important it is in political and economic spheres in this book that you've written, The End of Oil. And I wanted just to quote from the book here. You say, in today's growth-dependent, energy-intensive global economy, oil price volatility itself may eventually pose more risk to prosperity and stability and simple survival than terrorism or even war. In this bleak context, it becomes easier to understand why nations as powerful and technologically advanced as Japan, Britain, and the U.S. have such abysmal records when it comes to long-term energy planning or alternative energy. But, you know, on the other hand, shouldn't that make it clear that we need to be concerned about depletion, about other sources of energy, about long-term energy planning?
Well, absolutely. I mean, if you're an alien from another planet and you were floating down here for the first time, you were looking at the global energy system, you'd say, wow, you know, this energy system is highly dependent on fossil fuels, particularly oil. Oil provides 40% of the world's energy and, as importantly, 90% of its transportation fuel. Okay, now, where does the world get its oil? Well, it turns out that the oil is, most of it's found in these politically unstable regions, as we've been talking about.
Mm-hmm.
there is a scarcity issue because, you know, the aliens would be saying, well, it looks like your oil is finite, so at some point you're going to hit a production peak and then prices are going to go up, so that doesn't seem a very solid basis for an energy system. And lastly, it turns out that the way you burn oil and natural gas and coal produces all this carbon dioxide, which, although you're still debating this at your, in your various government halls, seems to be affecting your climate. So for three powerful reasons, you, as a human race, ought to be thinking about moving beyond oil and hydrocarbons generally, and you're not, you know, so why not? And there's a host of reasons, and it's And we like to point fingers. We like to imagine that simply the greed of corporations and the corruption of political officials that keeps a new energy system from evolving. And yet, although there is certainly enough of that to go around, you know, there's the larger issue, which is it costs money. You know, this energy system we've built ourselves, and which it must be said has done a pretty good job of serving our needs for a century or so. This energy system costs a lot of money. They estimate it's about $10 trillion in various assets, you know, pipelines and refineries and all this stuff. And as much as we might wish that it didn't exist and that we could replace it with something, all those assets need to be dealt with. I mean, let's say you went out in the driveway and looked at your car and you said, you know, I just bought this thing last month, but the fuel efficiency is so crummy, I got to get rid of it. Well, you know, what are you going to do? You're going to just dump it? You're not going to go abandon it. You're going to try to sell it, but of course the resale value, as soon as you drove off the lot, you lost, you know, a quarter of its resale value. So you're facing a loss. The only thing you can do is use it for a while. I mean, from a business standpoint, the only thing you do is use it for a while until you've gained some value back, and then you sell it. Well, that's what all these owners of energy assets are faced with. You know, whether you're a coal-fired utility or you own a pipeline or an oil tanker, you have invested a lot of money in it, and the last thing you want to hear is that you're going to have to dump that because some president or some environmental group wants us to move to a hydrogen economy. And this we call this asset inertia, is one of the most potent, forces in this whole energy equation, because it's not going to go away, and it's going to resist efforts to change the energy system. And what it means is that our plans to change, our long-term plans, have to take into account these assets. And have to acknowledge that the owners of these assets aren't in a hurry to get rid of them and will need incentives to start moving. And that is a really tough issue for a lot of energy advocates and those who want to change to understand and accept.
Yeah. And also, this was interesting to think about as I was reading The End of Oil. You know, big oil has become even bigger. The companies have doubled in size as they've merged. How is that affecting the industry? You mentioned in the book, I think you put it this way: is that they can't hit singles, they can't walk to a base, to use a baseball the baseball metaphors. They got to keep hitting home runs.
That's right.
So this is like the SUV parked in our driveway.
In a sense, it is. I mean, they have been forced through various kind of market realities to merge, to create these mega companies, because that's how you compete. And yet, being that size, they have to deal with huge chunks of business, which in the case of an oil company means huge oil discoveries. You know, if they go out and drill for oil, they want to hit on the first drill, first of all, the first well they sink. They want to hit an oil field, and they need that oil field to be huge, because if they have to drill a bunch of smaller oil fields, the costs are astronomical, and they begin losing money. Now, it's tough to have much sympathy for oil companies given how much money they're making right now. They are making money hand over fist, and they are not at all sad to see prices this high. But you have to keep in mind that, you know, high oil prices have traditionally been followed by low oil prices. I mean, what happens is, as prices go up, oil companies go look for more oil, and just eventually they bring onto the market a flood of oil, and that sinks the prices. And essentially, so companies are asking themselves, well, we got this pile of money in the bank now. Where do we invest it? Do we invest it in new oil wells, or do we invest it in some other kind of energy? And I think that's really the question that we have to, you know, yes, we can be mad they're making lots of money, but the more important question is, what are they going to do with all that money they've just earned?
Well, what do big oil company people have to say about that very question?
Well, it depends which oil companies you're talking to. Oil companies have personalities, and different corporate cultures and different attitudes and beliefs about what the future is going to bring and different attitudes about how long they can hold on, you know, to the status quo. You will have a company like British Petroleum or, until recently, Shell Oil, which spent a lot of time at least talking about getting beyond petroleum, you know, investing in hydrogen, in solar, in wind, and, you know, really kind of staking out that more future-oriented position in the market and making that part of their brand. And then you have companies like ExxonMobil, which until recently wouldn't even acknowledge that there was a debate about climate change, you know, because internally they understood exactly what was going on. They have some of the best scientists in the world, but they felt that politically it was not in their interest to even talk about it because they're the biggest oil company. They have the most to gain by holding on to the status quo, and thus they face the biggest risk in jumping to a different kind of energy system. Now, ExxonMobil, I mean, this is a foreign oil company said, look, ExxonMobil is the biggest oil company in the world. They have the most cash, the most assets. What they will do is they will wait and wait and pretend there's no problem, no need to change, and then if they see a new market developing, a new energy system developing, whether it be hydrogen or solar or, you know, you name it, they have enough money, they'll just buy their way into it. But they'll wait until that market develops, and then they'll see if it's profitable, and then they'll buy their way into it. Other companies, smaller companies, feel like they can't wait that long. They have to be the pioneer. The tough thing for a company, though, is that you could take any company right now and say, the CEO of it, the boss could say, well, what do we need to do to be a hydrogen company? What if we wanted to be the leader in hydrogen? What would we do? Well, the first thing you'd do is you'd sell all your oil assets and you'd just buy natural gas because natural gas is the easiest thing to make hydrogen out of. And then you'd invest heavily in hydrogen technology and making hydrogen from electricity and solar and wind. And you'd set yourself up and you'd hire all these hydrogen experts. And you'd set yourself up to be the hydrogen company. And then next year you'd go out of business because all of your competitors who stayed oil companies would be kicking your butt.
Mm-hmm.
Because the here and now still demands that oil companies be oil companies. So these companies, and again, this isn't to say that they deserve a lot of sympathy, but we should understand the realities that they face, which is, you know, you can't change overnight. And if you do, you will lose your job.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit more about the economics. I'm not quite sure I understand this. A moment ago you talked about, you know, the big guys might just, you know, sit on the sidelines till they see the market there. So, and it has to be developed. So, in a sense, some of the littler companies or the more progressive companies could begin that effort toward building capital for and building the new market.
Mm-hmm.
But that seems like that's...
What's to keep them from getting hammered?
Yeah.
Well, I think what you need to do is, what they're looking for is some sort of assurance that there's a market. I mean, right now an oil company knows it can sell oil because, goodness, everyone uses it. There isn't a similar assurance for, say, hydrogen. So let's say that we're going to try to encourage companies to invest in hydrogen. Well, you need to say, first of all, we need some sort of a small fleet of hydrogen vehicles. So let's say the government says, all right, well, let's make the U.S. postal system the hydrogen fleet. And let's just do it in California. Well, that's a lot of rigs. But what it would allow is the government says, okay, next time we're going to buy a bunch of hydrogen cars. So this would give car makers an assured market, right? They could roll out a kind of a demo fleet. And it would allow, since it's a fleet, it would allow you to train your drivers all to use hydrogen and to drive hydrogen rigs. It would allow for a central fueling place because you go back to the main post office to fuel up, so you don't have to worry about hydrogen gas stations. And you could also do your maintenance there, too. So you've got this fleet of vehicles. It's running on hydrogen. So now British Petroleum, let's say, goes, okay, good. I know I've got a fleet of vehicles, and I'm going to, and they'll use this much hydrogen every year, so I am going to, you know, refine this much hydrogen. I know I can do it. I can get away with it. I can invest this much money in new systems and feel that I'm going to get a return on my investment. It starts small. Then let's say you decide to roll out hydrogen vehicles in, you know, Arizona. And see what I'm saying? You gradually roll out. You increase your market size incrementally and in ways that decrease the risk to energy companies.
Mm.
Now, of course, that requires that the government wants to do that in the first place and is willing to spend the money. But I think that that's the way it's probably going to need to happen.
Yeah. Well, also, we've got the problem with the hydrogen car that it's not exactly a a great technology at the moment. I mean, well,
not yet, of course, but let's say, you know, it has engineering hurdles. We've got to figure out how to bring down the cost, and there's some things that we need to take care of in terms of the reliability, fuel tanks on board, increasing the range of the cars, the driving range, so that consumers actually want to buy it. But I think these are things that are within reach. If car companies felt that there was a market, they might be willing to invest in the research to kind of overcome these last hurdles. And if they knew, for example, that the U.S. was going to start rolling out, you know, postal vehicles, or if New York taxi's fleet was going to be powered by hydrogen, they might feel a little more secure in making those investments. Again, it's kind of a chicken and egg thing. I think as it stands right now, the auto companies don't want to jump in on hydrogen, you know, and make hydrogen cars because there's no fueling system and there's no assured market, and the fuel companies don't want to, you know, invest in new hydrogen refineries because there's no cars to use it. So we could sit there and, you know, stand and stare at each other for the next 20 or 30 years, or we could just try to find some way to incrementally build up demand.
Yeah. Now, do the big companies at all, the big oil companies, do they see the end of oil?
Well, it really varies. I mean, there are within, you know, officially, we have plenty of oil. It's just a matter of encouraging the investment in the right regions. It's a matter of reducing environmental regulation that prevents us from drilling. I mean, for example, you hear a lot of talk about if we were to just let oil companies drill in the Arctic, we'd have boatloads of oil, but most oil companies recognize that there's limited prospects outside of OPEC. You know, that really the game is the Middle East, and it's, you know, there's some in Africa and there's a great deal in Russia, but really, you know, oil companies know that if they're not allowed to get into Russia, especially the Middle East, they will lose market share over time. So they know that oil is not long term. You know, they see a couple more decades at least. But they don't think that they're going to be selling oil in 2075. All right? They don't know what they'll be selling exactly, and they don't want the government to say, this is the technology that you will be selling, because they feel that the market should have a lot more to say about what the technology is. But they recognize it's coming, especially if you talk to people within the companies who aren't official spokesmen. You know, I've talked with some people at BP who disagree fundamentally with their company's official line, and they believe much more strongly that, you know, that a peak in global oil production is coming much sooner than, you know, company officials will say, and they're disappointed that both their company and governments generally haven't taken a stronger initiative in you know, planning for it. But, you know, officially the companies, just like the U.S., you know, no one wants to set off alarm bells because they're afraid. What would happen if the U.S. government came out tomorrow and said, hey, we are worried about oil supplies? It would, it would cause uneasiness in the market, and that's kind of the last thing the U.S. wants.
Well, you point out in the book, I think it was a Saudi official said to you that if everyone in the United States went up to the gas station tomorrow and filled their tank all the way full, we'd be in trouble.
There was some concern that it would create a temporary pinch in supply, that's how tight things were.
Yeah.
The guy was simply saying that's how closely supply actually matches regular demand.
Journalist Paul Roberts is our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. We're talking with him about his book, The End of Oil, On the Edge of a Perilous New World. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon. I invite your questions, your comments. The telephone number is 333-9455. That's the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. If you're outside the local dialing area, you can call us toll-free 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Let's talk with a listener in Urbana. Line one, go ahead.
Yes, I was wanting to know if you could talk a little bit about how fuel economy in cars has improved, or maybe not improved, over the last 30 years, and why, my opinion is it really hasn't kept pace with technology, but I'd be interested in knowing what your thoughts are on that.
So it's a perfect question for this conversation. You know, fuel efficiency has actually skyrocketed since the 70s. As we all recall, the high prices that followed the Arab oil embargo forced consumers to use less oil and pushed Congress to to basically legislate the car makers to make more fuel efficient cars, and they, after complaining that, you know, they wouldn't be able to do it, that they would have to produce tiny unsafe cars, they actually, you know, after a couple of years, really got on the stick and made remarkable improvements in the amount of horsepower that you could get out of a gallon of gasoline. It was phenomenal. Now, and so, and for a while, that was translated into better miles per gallon. Our cars were, they weren't that much smaller, but they were much more fuel efficient. The problem is that there was no law saying that all those horsepower had to be used for better fuel economy, because you get this efficiency dividend when you make your engines more efficient, and you can use that efficiency dividend anywhere. You can use it to make the car go farther for the same gallon, or you can use it to make an engine that produces more power for the same gallon. And so you could build a heavier car. And so what was happening, what Detroit began doing, was building these bigger cars with more features, more amenities, you know, more powerful air conditioning, all these different things. And so the engines were more efficient, but instead of using that power to create cars that got more miles per gallon, they were using that efficiency to create heavier cars, more luxurious cars. The result was that we now have a fleet of new cars that's actually, has the lowest average fuel efficiency, or fuel economy rather, than any time since the mid-80s. So we've essentially gone backwards. And really, it's not the sole reason that American oil demand is going up every year, but it's one of the biggest reasons. And so it's one of the biggest problems. It is also, though, one of the biggest opportunities to turn the picture around.
I have a Chevrolet from the mid-70s that occasionally I'll drive cross country, and I'm getting 18 miles to the gallon with that car. And now I have friends of mine who bought trucks, and I think they're lucky if they get 12 to 15.
It is. We live in a world where we have a kind of a market-based reality, and that is, what that market reality says is, if you can afford it, you can have it. All right. So if they can afford a car that gets 12 miles a gallon, or a Humvee that gets 4, or a gigantic house that uses twice as much energy as the one they had 20 years ago, then this market-based reality we have says they should be able to have it. If they want to spend, you know, $50,000 on a BMW that has like 400 horsepower under its hood, that's their business. And we've lived that way and accepted that for decades. It's really a part of the American way of life. And in fact, Western thought is dominated by that notion. If you can afford it, you can have it. And I think what we're coming to realize is that, you know, while that's a very important element and has to remain an important part of our culture, affording it needs to be redefined, because the cost of owning these cars and having this poor fuel efficiency isn't simply in your wallet. There are environmental and political costs as well.
Driving the problem. It's kind of like the argument with drug users driving a drug trade.
Right.
And then you'll have people in this country who are literally throwing energy away, you know, that who knows what future generations are going to be saying about our extravagant use of this energy. We don't know that it doesn't have, more uses than just simply getting us, to the supermarket. But anyway, thank you very much.
Well, thanks for your call.
Let's talk with another listener. A listener on the toll-free line, line 4, a caller in Eureka. Hi.
Hi. An interesting conversation. I'm wondering if you could come up with a figure or a figure that's given that when, for all practical purposes, the supply of oil as we know it would run out, and I guess you were mentioning doubling or almost doubling of the demand within 20 or 30 years.
Well, I think that, if I knew when the supply of oil was going to run out, I wouldn't be talking here. I'd be on the phone to a broker because, I could make a boatload of money, and I think that's the big question. You know, what people, the question is this: when does the production of oil peak? In other words, when is it no longer possible to keep increasing the amount of oil we get out of the ground? It doesn't mean that oil disappears. It means that that production can't follow demand. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And what you'll hear, there's a range of opinions. The optimists would say we won't see a production peak until, say, 2035. Okay, that's basically 3 decades, not forever, but it's plenty of time to find alternatives. Pessimists will say that the peak has already happened, and that it's simply our ability to produce heavily, pretty much at will right now, that's masking that effect. We don't know it yet. We won't know it for a couple of years. My sense is the best way to look at this is that you have to divide the oil world into two parts. You have to look at it as OPEC and non-OPEC. OPEC has got tons of oil, lots of oil, easy oil, cheap oil, and their production, you know, they're probably not going to peak for, you hear, like 20 years. The oil outside of OPEC, that's the one we have to be worried about, because once non-OPEC oil production peaks, and by that I mean oil production in Russia, in Africa, in the North Sea, and you know, certainly the Gulf of Mexico, once that peaks, we're forced to rely, we being the U.S. and other importers, are forced to rely more heavily on the Middle East, which changes the politics of oil completely. And what you'll hear is the production of that kind of oil, this non-OPEC oil, is probably sometime in the 2012-2015 region. And, you know, this doesn't mean, we don't run out of oil. And there's lots of other things we can use as oil. An example is the tar sands up in Canada. There are the equivalent of a trillion barrels of oil locked away in the form of this tarry, oil-like substance. And in Alberta, and you can refine it using steam and other processes into a very usable synthetic crude. And you can do it at a price that's competitive with natural oil. So you know, if prices stay high, there's always those options. And that would give us, that would almost double the worldwide endowment of known oil reserves. So right
just
there,
using the tar sands in Alberta?
Right. The problem, though, is that oil, you know, what's been wonderful about the oil we've been using for centuries, it just flows out of the ground. This oil, you got to process.
Mm-hmm.
The processing takes a lot of energy. Now the Canadians use a great deal of natural gas, which is adding to the tightness of the North American gas market. As seriously, it uses a whole bunch of water. You got to use steam. And water, as we know, is becoming a constrained resource. And lastly, and this is probably the most important, producing oil from tar sands or from coal even, because you can produce a synthetic form of oil from coal, either process yields a huge amount of carbon dioxide. And the Canadians are already kind of been faced, they're in this dilemma. They've had to exempt their tar sand operations from Canada's agreement with the Kyoto Protocol. And really, so now they're faced with a choice. Is it, you know, produce lots of oil or deal with climate? And unfortunately, that's going to be a question that comes up again and again as we try to find ways to extend the fossil fuel energy economy.
May I ask one more question, please?
Sure.
Is there a benchmark figure, percentage figure, about what the OPEC oil-producing countries control of the total amount of known oil reserves?
Well, right now they're sitting on, you know, about two-thirds of the known oil, at least.
I see.
And they produce, in terms of the daily production, that's total oil. In terms of how much oil is produced every day, they produce about a third of the oil that's produced every day.
And you're saying that the non-OPEC producing countries, their production will begin to seriously go down around 2012 to 2015?
Right. But again, and there's a number of asterisks there. The first is that that's assuming we don't see any huge new discoveries, which it's getting less and less likely, given that we've been looking for about a century.
Mm-hmm.
And second is, that's assuming that we don't find a way to produce the tar sands, for example, in a way that doesn't yield carbon dioxide. I mean, it's quite possible, and this is something, you know, that we need to look at, that we'll come up with affordable technology that lets us use coal or tar sands or all other fossil fuels in a way that's carbon-free.
Mm-hmm.
But that would be great if we did. But we need to make the decision that we're going to go in that direction and start investing our research dollars right there.
Well, I want to thank the listener for his call, and we're going to go on to another caller, a listener in Champaign, line one. Hi.
Hello. Can you hear me?
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Yes. I'm wondering what the story is with China's demand for oil and its booming economy, and what that effect's going to be in the future on international politics and how that relates to Central Asia and Islamic fundamentalist desire to control that oil, or anyone else's desire, just plain Muslims or people in that area. Some of you could talk about China and the world economy, military domination, environment.
Okay,
terrorism.
Well, I think you've put your finger on a hot button in terms of energy future. Chinese demand is going faster than folks had anticipated, for all commodities, but energy in particular. Like America, China can't produce enough oil at home. In fact, since about 1994, it's had to import. it has to import from the same place that everyone else does. Right now, there's a bidding war between China and Japan over oil from Siberia. But really, the end game here is the Middle East. You know, China is just as interested in oil from Saudi Arabia and Kuwait and Iraq as anyone else is, and is working very hard to develop relationships with those countries, is running, you know, encountering all sorts of resistance from the U.S. You know, the U.S. would rather not have China, you know, develop any sort of a dominant relationship with the Saudis, for example. But, you know, some people see that as kind of the future, that the Saudis are looking at world oil markets, and they're looking at the big consumers, and they're saying that, well, the U.S. is the most dominant market today, but what about 5 years from now? Do we want to have, you know, start developing a relationship with China today so that we have a piece of that all-important, you know, Chinese market? So, I mean, that's affecting oil politics already. And I think longer term, you know, it's not too hard to imagine a scenario in which countries the size of, you know, China and in India, India is already a big player and will be much bigger, but countries like India and China, Japan, the U.S., find themselves increasingly competing for, you know, oil, which is increasingly in one place, the Middle East. And, you know, you'll certainly hear the arguments that say, well, oil is just a commodity, and, you know, people will pay, you know, the market will determine a price, and your access to that commodity will be dependent on how much you can pay. But the fact is that oil is much more than just a commodity. It's a very political commodity. Countries have to have it to run their economies, to maintain energy security, to maintain political power. And so the things they're willing to do, the steps they're willing to take to maintain access to that oil, often go well beyond what they would do to maintain access to, say, tin or copper. And you can picture, I mean, right now it's a bidding war. It's a diplomatic war. It's a commercial war. But, I mean, how much farther do we have to go before it becomes something more than political?
Right, and what about the fact that there are Islamic groups that are being repressed in China right now, so China is using the war on terrorism as an excuse, you know, we're your allies in the war on terrorism, but how long do you think that's going to go on?
Well, I think that, you know, the Chinese have a, you know, face a pretty big... I mean, they have an Islamic problem of their own. It's relatively small at this point, and it's mainly in a part of the country where the Chinese, not coincidentally, are wanting to build a pipeline from the Caspian region into China. I mean, what they see is, you know, they would like to have a chunk of this oil that's being discovered in these former Soviet republics, and they'd like to build a pipeline. And one of their concerns will be that pipeline's going to have to go through an area that has some trouble with Islamic, you know, fundamentalist groups. I think that, like any other country, they're going to deal. I don't think they face near the threat that, say, from these groups that, say, Saudi Arabia does, though.
No, not at all.
So, but I, you know, China is not only is it a big market, and not only is it kind of this kind of new player, but it's really the shape. It's the shape of the energy future. It's really a wake up call for us because we've really focused mostly on getting energy to industrial players, industrial countries, you know, Europe and Japan and America, and we've been concerned with energy security in the context of industrial players. And now China's forcing us to realize that there's this entire other part of the world that would very much like to have the economic development that we have, and the wealth, and the luxury, and the convenience, you know, the toys and tools. But to get that, it's going to need economic growth, and to get that growth, it's going to need energy. And it's not just a matter anymore of them waiting for us to give it to them. As China demonstrates, they are going to take it. And
right.
Again, they'll take it in, you know, commercial ways now, but at some point, it's not hard to imagine that they might take it in other ways.
Right. Do you think that's what part of the new American century desire to control Central Asia is about?
Well, I certainly think that there are people in America, and as elsewhere, who are very concerned that America is quite soon to encounter a world in which competition for resources becomes to dominate, you know, the geopolitical arena. And that really what we're going to be doing is not fighting over, you know, the particular who has a weapon of mass destruction or, you know, who is repressing the Kurds. We'll be fighting over who has access to water and energy and uranium and tin, and that these new concerns, these new conflicts will really come to dominate the geopolitical scene.
I want to thank the listener for her call. I've got a couple other people waiting, so let's go next to our next listener, Champaign County, line two.
Good afternoon.
Hi.
The previous caller did mention what I like to call Pipelinistan, the Caspian Basin, kind of, but you didn't really do that in the inventory and didn't address it. I know that Bush cronies like Baker have major investments in that area, and I understand that it's not panning out. Is that a political problem, or is that a problem of the fact that they really overestimated the amount of oil in that region?
It's both. Clearly, the U.S. and other countries that were looking at that area, looking at the Caspian, and we're talking about Kazakhstan and Azerbaijan in particular, you know, these were former Soviet republics that had a great deal of oil, but they hadn't had the technology or the investment to get at it themselves, so they were waiting for Western help. The assumption was as soon as Western oil companies were allowed in, bingo, there'd be a lot of oil. Well, the fact, and there was an estimate by the U.S. government that there were 300 billion barrels of oil waiting to be tapped there, which would have been essentially a smaller version of Saudi Arabia, or about half as much as Saudi Arabia is supposed to have, and would have really changed politics forever. Okay, that was the hope. What's actually happened is, although they found some huge fields there, the fields are difficult to work, and they've been more expensive than hoped. Then there's the problem of getting the oil out to the world. I should say that they haven't found anywhere near as much as they'd hoped. So there's a lot of oil there, but not as much as they'd hoped. It's trapped. It's landlocked. So how do you build a pipeline out? And building a pipeline has turned out in that part of the world to be this incredible political headache. You know, you can build a pipeline across Iran. That would be the quickest, cheapest way. But, of course, the U.S. doesn't want to give Iran any, you know, leverage in that area. So then the U.S. says, well, let's build it through Azerbaijan and Georgia, and we'll build it through Turkey. And these are countries that are just racked by civil unrest, all sorts of rebellion. So that pipeline has been super expensive. The Chinese, of course, say, well, just build a pipeline to China. But not only is that, you know, traverse some tough ground, ground that's got wars going on it, and also is just geographically tough, but the U.S. doesn't want China to have access to oil, or at least control that much access to oil. The Russians, of course, they build the pipeline up to us, and up until recently, the U.S. didn't want Russia to have control either. Now, since 9/11, the U.S. and Russia have become oil buddies. But to answer your caller's question, it's both. There wasn't as much oil as people had hoped, and second, pipeline politics has proven to be an enormous headache. And so, you know, eventually we're going to get oil out of there, but it's going to come on the market a lot more slowly, I think, than people had hoped, and it's not going to be the next Middle East, the answer to the Middle East that people were thinking it would be.
Isn't it true that Russia and U.S. aren't quite the oil buddies that it was promised either? I mean, they're Khodorkovsky is and his oil company were trying to make a deal with ExxonMobil, and that's one of the things that a lot of people think was actually at the root of, you know, I'm sure he did do a lot of crime. They're all doing a lot of crime, but the fact that he was taken the way he was taken, and his oil company's been, I think, sort of semi-renationalized. And,
right.
And the standoff in Georgia is we now have one of our, I guess, a Princeton-educated guy. I forget where the new guy in Georgia is.
Right.
But the Soviets still have bases there, and they have a large enclave of Russian speakers who are there. This is part of the standoff too, isn't it? Frankly,
well, your point's well taken. I mean, prior to 9/11, the U.S. was very leery of giving Russia additional power in the coming oil market. After 9/11. You know, the U.S. needed an ally in that area. We definitely wanted to have an alternative to Middle Eastern oil because we felt that was just a time bomb. Russia seemed the obvious partner there, and they were willing to play. And I think what has happened is that, you know, we always knew that our alliance with Russia wouldn't be government to government. It would ultimately be between oil companies because that's how oil's moved, which would require alliances between Western oil companies and these big Russian oil companies. And the real problem has been, first and foremost, that the Russian environment for investment is just not as stable as a lot of Western oil companies had hoped. And so they go in, they have all these high hopes for a deal, and they discover that these Russian oil companies are, you know, they've been run illegally, their accounting is all screwed up, they're overvalued. And if you're an oil company, you know, say Shell or BP or, you know, ExxonMobil, and you're thinking about investing billions of dollars, You look again, because this may be a place to lose your money. You know, you might instead go to Africa. You might instead go to the Gulf of Mexico. The point being that the Russian, the alliance that was supposed to free us from our dependence on oil from the Middle East, hasn't really come to fruit, and it's not just a political thing. It's the fact that, you know, a lot of times these Western oil companies have looked at their counterparts in Russia and said, I don't know if I want to do business with them.
I suppose if there had been as much oil as they had hoped for, that there would have been a little less fighting over the spoils, so maybe
it would have gone
a little better.
The other thing, too, is that Russia realizes that there's a real question for oil producers, how fast you produce your oil. You know, during the 70s, when the Arab OPEC countries were really coming into their own, you know, there was a big question as to, do we produce all the oil now, get the cash, and invest it elsewhere, or does it make the most sense to leave the oil in the ground and produce it gradually? And Russia's facing this question now. I mean, they're doing everything they can to ramp up oil production as fast as possible because they want to take advantage of this growing market and get these prices. But there's a case to be made that they should be slowing down their production. They should be developing other non-oil industries, not just pumping oil revenues back into making more oil, but trying to diversify because, as we've seen elsewhere in the world, countries that rely, you know, primarily on oil for their revenues screw up their economies in huge ways. I mean, there is not a single country that, you know, where oil is the main source of hard currency that hasn't seen their economies deteriorate since oil was discovered. It just doesn't happen. The places where countries have succeeded are those places like Norway and England and the U.S. that had other industries going before oil was discovered. Russia's teetering on the edge. Oil provides an enormous chunk of their revenues, and although they have other industries, they're really facing a thing now where they'll be getting a growing amount of money from their energy business, and that's a really dangerous position to be in.
Mm. I want to thank our caller in Champaign County. I've got one more caller waiting, so let's go and talk with this listener in Lafayette, Indiana. Hi.
Hi. It seems to me that the idea of producing hydrogen from a hydrocarbon is a fundamental fallacy, and that if we're going to start developing our hydrogen economy, the first thing to do is to realize that there is an existing industrial demand for hydrogen and then start producing it on a more sound basis. And to me, windmills do provide cheap electricity, but they are somewhat difficult to integrate into the power grid. So using them to produce hydrogen seems to me to make the most sense.
I think that's a great example of both a problem that we're going to have to confront and a possible solution. Your caller's exactly right. You know, we're talking about a hydrogen economy, but we haven't talked about where the hydrogen is going to come from. And if we are concerned about climate, then we need to, and about scarcity of hydrocarbons generally, we need to be thinking more long-term. You know, you can make hydrogen from electricity, and you can make electricity from renewable sources like wind and solar. So the question is, can we produce enough wind and solar power to really fund a hydrogen economy? And here, this is a tough one, because what you realize is the reason that oil and gas and coal have been so successful is that they pack a lot of energy in a small place. They have what we call high power density. And this means that, for example, a coal-fired power plant takes up, I don't know, a dozen acres, you know, a few hundred acres maybe, and provides power for a medium-sized city. If you're going to provide power for a medium-sized city using windmills, you need, you know, hundreds of square miles, thousands of square miles of windmills, and probably even more solar panels. And since more and more people are going to live in what they call these megacities in the future, we need to find a way to concentrate renewable energy. Now, hydrogen provides that way. You could devote large chunks of, say, the Midwest or the Middle East to generating solar power or wind power. You could convert that electricity through electrolysis to hydrogen, store the hydrogen, pipe it all over the country. It would become the new kind of natural gas or oil, much as we do today. You could use it to fuel your cars, your fuel cell cars, or to power your home, whatever you want. That's the kind of the dream. The challenge will be building that size of an infrastructure, finding the money to do it, encouraging private investors to do it. I mean, it's doable, clearly, but it's a project of massive scale and will require a commitment at all levels, government and industry, and from the consumers as well.
Yeah. Well, speaking of consumers, maybe that's where we should wrap up here this afternoon. We mentioned earlier, we talked a little bit about this, the importance of conservation. And I think one of the reasons you wrote this book is to kind of bring us up to speed on this very complicated topic of energy. So parting words from you, Paul Roberts, in terms of what we can do in our own backyards.
Get educated. You know, really, it really, what I discovered is that we have a pretty profound level of energy illiteracy in this country, and it's not entirely, you know, the fault of oil companies and government. We just stopped paying attention because, you know, energy has been so cheap we haven't had to. Energy is transparent. We don't have to pay. We don't have to ask where it comes from, and we really need to reverse that. We need to ask ourselves. We need to become very conversant in energy, all phases of it. So, and there are so many websites. The government's website, you know, the Department of Energy website, the Energy Information Administration website, are both really good places just to start. We need a conversation, a national conversation about energy. We started one in the 70s when prices were high, and we've kind of stopped talking about it. And it's allowed us to sink into a fairly facile and, I believe, incorrect image of our energy. And right now we think that energy is primarily about the price of the gasoline pump and greedy Arabs and conspiring oil companies. And, you know, that we need a much deeper understanding. We need to start talking about it. And I guess the third thing I would suggest is consumers need to do a little thought experiment. They need to ask themselves, what would happen if I believed that high energy prices were here to stay? Because this is the critical thing. You know, once there's a threshold of belief that prices are high, consumers begin making changes. And this is, we saw this in the 70s. Right now, a lot of people think that the high prices are seasonal. We're gonna see gasoline fall back down in the autumn like it does every year. And if that happens, you know, fine. The issue will come back up again. But if it doesn't, if prices do stay higher than they were last year, that may be the threshold that we've been looking for. Consumers make some decisions. And maybe what we need to ask ourselves right now is, if I did think prices were going to be high, what would I do differently? For a lot of people, it's a car decision. Other people might consider commuting. Other people might consider rethinking where they live in relation to their work. It doesn't mean you necessarily need to take the action, but you need to start considering it, because the last thing anyone wants to be, you know, anyone wants to happen, whether you're a consumer or a government or a company, is be caught by surprise and forced to make a decision. Because in almost all cases, being forced to make an energy decision will lead us to choose badly.
Mm. Paul Roberts, thank you very much for talking with us this afternoon.
Well, it was my pleasure.
Paul Roberts is a journalist. He's the author of The End of Oil, On the Edge of a Perilous New World. The book is published by Houghton Mifflin.
Today's programming is made possible in part by grants from 10,000 Villages in downtown Champaign and Crossroads Global Handcrafts, 428 North Main in Bloomington, offering ground and whole bean coffee purchased from farmers using internationally recognized fair trade standards.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
Chuck Bullard from Omaha, Nebraska writes, Dear Dr. Science, why do animals see only in visible light?
Check your data. Last time I noticed, my cat was staring at dust motes, which in ultraviolet light resemble iridescent gummy worms. No wonder these fanciful felines can spend the greater part of a morning just staring at a sunbeam. Dogs, on the other hand, see in infrared, which is why a TV's remote control can render even the most savage attack dog a whimpering puppy. I carry a spare remote